Good morning. May I please the court? I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal, please. This case is about the appellee's termination of my client's employment after 7 years of service in violation of the Fair Employment and Housing Act, as well as common law, and in addition to Labor Code Section 1102.5 of the California Labor Code. By way of grant, a summary judgment made without oral arguments, the district court dismissed plaintiff's entire case against his former employees for harassing him, terminating him based on discriminatory as well as retaliatory reasons. The evidence and the California law showed that the district court erred in doing so. Now, this is an employment civil rights case, and this court has consistently held that in an employment civil rights case that very little evidence is necessary to survive summary judgment in such a case, because the ultimate question is one that can only be resolved through a searching inquiry, one that is most appropriately conducted by the fact finder upon a full record at time of trial to determine what the true motive was. We examined this case, district court examined this case through the McDonnell-Douglas framework, and I'll speak to the retaliation claim first, then the discrimination claim, and then the harassment claim. With the retaliation claim, the district court found that there was a prima facie case, and the appellees do not dispute that. The district court then found that there was the appellees had proffered non-discriminatory reasons for the termination of my client's employment. Appellant does not dispute that. The crux of this issue, at least as to the retaliation claims in violation of the Fair Employment and Housing Act, as well as California Labor Code 1102.5, is whether the proffered reasons for my client's termination was pretextual. In support of the retaliation claim, whistleblower retaliation in violation of the Section 1102.5 claim, there is direct evidence in the form of the declarations of not just my client, but the declarations of two current, at least at that time, current employees of appellees, as well as one former employee, all of whom describe my client as a hard worker, an excellent worker, some would describe him as.
Counsel, that just doesn't go to the question of pretext.
Right,
So where's the error in pretext? What was the pretext? What's your evidence that they engaged pretextually? They conducted an independent investigation. They talked to all of the witnesses. They went back, talked to a couple of people twice. Your client was spoken to twice. There's a written report as to all the reasons as to why they were going to terminate him. Where's the pretext?
And that's the proffered reason. But the pretext comes when my client made safety complaints throughout his employment, and especially beginning in June 2013, where he would provide in writing the reasons why there are safety concerns and why he either needs to be transferred out or he needs to some kind of remediation. And the appellees do nothing to address these safety concerns. They don't separate him. They don't transfer him. They really don't do any kind of an investigation.
Well, they did do an investigation, counsel. They went and talked to the outside contractors who said this guy's been harassing them. One gal said he's been stalking me, and she suggests, at least the way I read her testimony, was that he was using the lack of the fact that she wasn't wearing a hard hat as sort of the reason to go after her and stalk her. They talked to a number of people who said they were very uncomfortable, that he was out of control when he spoke with them, that he used bad language on occasion, and that although he may have been nominally complaining about safety concerns, always somebody not wearing a hard hat, that he was rude and inconsiderate to outside people.
And first, my client disputes those allegations completely. He acknowledges that he had asked outside contractors to wear their...
Right, but Tesoro has conducted an outside investigation. They brought somebody in here to do all of this. So where's the pretext?
So, Your Honor, that was an investigation into allegations against him. But allegations against my client made against his supervisor, those were never investigated. That is the investigation that I was referring to, that the
You're talking about the letters that he wrote to
Yes, to the chairman of appellees, to the vice president, Daniel Carlson, to Kevin.
And none of those, not one of those letters says that he's being discriminated on the basis of his race.
And so I understand that, and that is why I'm starting with retaliation, Your Honor, that he made safety concerns saying that there was a hostile work environment, that his safety concerns were not addressed when he raised
them. He doesn't complain of a hostile work environment.
He
doesn't like his supervisor. That's clear. And he actually writes very polite letters. He actually writes extremely well.
I agree, Your Honor. And he makes these
So they're very articulate letters. And he does not complain of race. He does not complain of a hostile work environment.
He complains of safety concerns, and they're not being addressed. And that's why I'm focusing on this. But the pretext also comes, there's direct evidence that the people, his co-workers, the people who interact with Mr. Allen and with my client, Mr. Raphael, they see that his safety concerns have a negative impact on how appellees treat my client and how his supervisor
So is your theory of the case that this is not a case about race discrimination?
Your Honor, there's different issues. And so
for right now on the retaliation, it's just retaliation because he's complaining of safety concerns.
There's actually two separate causes of action. I'll move on to the FEHA claims, though, because the district court uses the same analysis for the Section 1102.5 claims as well as the FEHA claims. And that my client, he made two separate charges of discrimination that he submitted to the EEOC, and then the EEOC then notified appellees about my client's discrimination charges. The first time was in September 2013, and the appellees were notified as of October 21st, 2013, of the claim of racial discrimination. Soon thereafter, he is suspended for cursing, excuse my language, but his version says, "Why do you give me the shit jobs?" to Lauren Allen, the supervisor who he has complained consistently and in writing.
I don't see anything that he ever filed with anyone that says I'm being discriminated on the basis of my race.
Except for, so there are EEOC charges of discrimination, and that's part of the record
But in September 2013. None of the interviews with the investigator prior to his termination did he complain about being discriminated on the basis of race. We have a couple of declarations from some of his coworkers and from the woman that he went with to one of the parties. So I've seen that. But I didn't see anything here where and when he was asked in his deposition, I just didn't see the race claims.
Well, Your Honor, he had a good faith basis to go to the EEOC and allege racial discrimination. So I understand that in the internal interviews, which he says that were very curt, he did not explicitly say that he was being discriminated against on race, and as well as in his letters, he did not.
I'm looking at his deposition. Did Mr. Allen ever say anything to you that was discriminatory based on your race? Not that I recall. Did he ever say anything that was discriminatory based on your national origin? Not that I recall.
I understand that's what his deposition says, but he also submitted charges of discrimination to the EEOC, which the EEOC then notified.
Was this deposition taken after he filed the EEOC charges or before?
After, Your Honor.
Okay. So the latest information, the latest evidence, when he was put under deposition after he filed the EEOC charges, he says, I don't have any evidence. I'm not claiming race discrimination against Mr. Allen, my supervisor, or national origin discrimination. So what are we supposed to do here, counsel?
Your Honor, it's not what he said, it's what appellees did. They terminated his employment and they suspended his employment.
Right, for non-pretextual reasons. There's just nothing about race in any of the reasons that they gave. And I'm trying to figure out where the refutation of that is. Where have you shown that it was pretextual?
Well, there's direct evidence of the race discrimination through the declarations of Robert Ritchie as well as Astrid Labate. And so this
Ms. Labate's declaration, of course, is years old. That's the holiday party.
Yes, in December 2012, Your Honor. But just like in this case, just like this court decided in Mays versus Winco, direct evidence of discrimination, even 4 years prior to the ultimate decision of termination, can be still used as direct evidence to find a pretextual reason to at least submit this, these claims to a finder of fact and not be disposed of at a summary judgment where there's limited information.
Do we have evidence that Mr. Allen was in fact the decision maker when it came to your client's termination?
He was a participant in there, but because he made the report, and in this in the Dominguez-Curry case, that the animus of a supervisor who affects the ultimate decision or even just influences it can be grounds to.
Right, that's why I was asking. So do we have evidence that he, I guess in your words, that he influenced the decision?
Yes, Your Honor. He was the one who took Mr. Rafael to Human Resources, who then suspended his his employment and then terminated it based on his word.
But I thought the termination was occurred after an independent investigation and was actually instituted by other folks higher up in the company.
You say independent, it wasn't an outside, it was an internal by Ms. Fisher.
Yes, that's fair, yes. Right.
And then Ms. Fisher.
But independent of Mr. Allen, I guess, is what I was trying to convey. That in other words, I understand what you're saying, that he's, maybe Mr. Allen got the ball rolling, but my understanding was that other folks then took over the responsibility for investigating whether the charges against your client had merit, and then somebody else made the ultimate decision to terminate him based on that investigation.
Well, Mr. Allen certainly participated and influenced the decision to terminate my client's employment because he, as Your Honor said, got the ball rolling by making these allegations against my client, which he strenuously.
But these are allegations that, as a supervisor, he's in the ordinary course of his duties, he's got to make if he thinks that there's something wrong. Now, it may be that it's motivated by race, but that would be that's why HR would come in and investigate the whole thing. That's why they interviewed everybody and concluded that it was not motivated by race, that it was motivated because of your client's bad behavior towards outside contractors, and that there was a repeating pattern there that needed to be addressed. And Mr. Allen was not part of the ultimate decision to terminate him. Sure, there was a complaint by Mr. Allen about what he had done after they had a bad incident. But where's Mr. Allen's role in termination, other than doing what a supervisor would be expected to do?
Well, he certainly participated by being interviewed and by being asked.
He would have been subject to being terminated if he hadn't cooperated in the investigation.
He being my client?
No, oh. Mr. Allen. Mr. Allen had to cooperate in the investigation. Your client cooperated. He had to, just like Mr. Allen. But Mr. Allen was not involved in the decision to terminate him.
Yes, that's correct. There's no evidence of that issue, but there doesn't need to be direct involvement. The supervisor, Mr. Allen, does not need to be the ultimate decision maker. The Dominguez-Curry case just requires influence or participation.
Well, what's the influence or participation other than the fact that he had to cooperate in an internal investigation? Do you have evidence that he lied?
That Mr. Allen lied?
Yeah.
Yes.
You have evidence of that?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the evidence?
The evidence is that my client states that he did not make the allegation. He did not make he did not say what he said. And also the four people that were interviewed by Ms. Fisher couldn't corroborate what Mr. Allen said. And they were within a platform.
He wasn't just fired because of what he said to Mr. Allen. He was fired because of what he said to outside contractors.
And my client, again.
Did all of them lie?
Yes. When viewing the evidence in favor of the plaintiff, the opposing party in a motion for summary judgment, my client says that did not happen, at least as to the way the aggressive approach that the outside contractors said that he did. And all of these contractors came about after he made his initial EEOC complaint. And so that is why one of the issues is I wanted to depose.
But I thought you agreed that there was a legitimate basis for firing him, but only that it had that it was pretextual. I thought that's how you started out.
I started out that the district court found that there was at least non-discriminatory reasons proffered. I didn't say that they were correct or.
I took it that you weren't addressing that. Okay.
Right, and I was just focusing on the pretext of that, the last step in the McDonnell-Douglas framework. Okay.
Mr. Lee, we've taken you well over your time.
Thank you.
I will give you a minute for rebuttal. Let's hear from Mr. Chamberlain.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Chamberlain for appellees. Tesoro Corporation and Tesoro Refining Marketing Company.
Maybe you could start with the race discrimination claims, because the declarations from the co-workers are troubling, in my view. They certainly suggest that Mr. Allen might have had some racist motivations for his interactions with the plaintiff. So maybe you can address why that, nonetheless, summary judgment was properly granted to your client.
Sure, and I think there are a couple points on that. And the first is that, as Your Honor noted, one of those declarations was from 2012, which was more than 2 years before he was terminated. And the other one was for some...
Do you think that Mr. Allen's racist views kind of dissipated between 2012 and 2014? That's the argument?
No, I don't think
I don't think that helps you much. So we have the two, I think, two declarations in particular, maybe three. Maybe forget about the timing of them and just address why you think summary judgment was nonetheless properly granted.
Fair enough. And to be clear, I do not think that Mr. Allen, there's been any evidence that Mr. Allen, in fact, held racist views. Let's talk about Astrid Labadie first. That was the one on the bus on the way to the Christmas party.
That's the 2012.
That's the 2012 right. Christmas party.
Yeah, I think it's the one that Judge Watford said wasn't particularly interesting.
Yes, and I think there are several reasons for that. First of all, what Ms. Labadie does not say what he actually said. She says she heard him make, and she didn't say it was a racist remark. She says she heard him make a derogatory remark towards Mr. Raphael.
Which she obviously interpreted as
which
being...
Which she concluded
right.
was racist, but without telling us what the remark was.
Right.
Ms. Labadie's conclusion as to what the meaning of that remark was doesn't tell us anything. What the judge found was that without evidence of what was actually said, we can't tell whether that was a racist remark or not. And her opinion, her unsupported opinion, doesn't constitute evidence of racial discrimination. I would also note that Mr.
Maybe not on
Raphael,
its own, but it certainly is supportive of the plaintiff's allegation, right? That somebody who was sitting right there and heard the remark interpreted it to be based on race.
Well, I would have 2 points on that. The first is that her opinion as to whether or not Mr. Allen, who she didn't even know who Mr. Allen was at the time, and her opinion that Mr. Allen, based on this one remark, was a racist, I think is hardly dispositive of the issue in front of us. The other point I would raise is that Mr. Raphael, according to Ms. Labadie, Mr. Raphael was sitting right next to her on the bus when the statement was made. Mr. Raphael was asked, did you ever hear Mr. Allen make a racist statement toward you? And he said no. So Mr. Raphael didn't even think it was a racist statement based on his deposition testimony. With regard to Mr. Ritchie, Mr. Ritchie's comment is frankly fairly similar to Ms. Labadie's. It occurred sometime earlier, we don't know when.
It's a little bit more concrete, and I grant you, he says it was prior to 2011, so it's
right.
even further back in time.
Right.
But it's more concrete in terms of the nature of the remark being race-based, right?
It is more concrete in that he at least says the remark was somehow based upon a bias against people from the Caribbean. He doesn't say what the remark was. And his opinion that it was a biased remark against people from the Caribbean, again, I just don't think is substantial evidence when it's unsupported by any facts.
But don't you think his subsequent statements in that same paragraph, which are quotes, don't you think those are connected to what he was saying? It's basically the intelligence level of Mr. Raphael.
The subsequent statements in that paragraph, I think that he viewed it to be that Cyrus Raphael did not have a brain and was stupid. Those comments?
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually think from the declaration it's not at all clear that those were part of the same comment. He references one specific comment that was made on a specific occasion that he interpreted as being derogatory towards people from the Caribbean. The other statements that he references are essentially, and I think this is what the district court held as well, is that all they indicated is that Mr. Allen believed that Mr. Raphael was incompetent. And he may very well have believed he was incompetent. That doesn't mean he was racist about it. That's Mr. Allen's job as his supervisor is to evaluate his performance. If he believed that his performance was not up to snuff and that he couldn't give him the tasks that someone who was more competent he could give to, that doesn't mean he's racist. That simply means he's doing his job as a supervisor.
Well, maybe, but I'm just looking again at that first sentence that basically on a daily basis, I mean, I'll just read it to you if you don't have it in front of you. It says, prior to 2011, in my presence, Lauren Allen made derogatory remarks about Caribbean people directed at Cyrus Raphael and on a daily basis said that he had, didn't have a brain, was stupid. And
agreed. It's I think those are, from just parsing that declaration, it's two separate statements. He said he made a comment that he was that he viewed as biased against Caribbean people. And then he says, and on a daily basis, he said that Mr. Raphael was stupid and didn't have a brain, something along those lines. First of all, that was, again, 4 years before the termination. So if Mr. Allen held those beliefs, he certainly waited a long time to act on them. And second of all, that, again, as a supervisor, his job is to evaluate the performance of Mr. Raphael. And those two comments, I don't believe, are linked in the declaration. There's certainly no reason to believe that they are, other than whoever drafted that declaration put them in the same paragraph.
And this gentleman, I take it, was not deposed?
This gentleman was not deposed. This declaration was submitted in opposition to the motion for summary judgment. He hadn't been identified prior to that.
What about the evidence of Mr. Allen's involvement in the decision to terminate?
Mr. Allen's involvement in that decision, even as Mr. Lee raises it, was solely the fact that he reported the comment that Mr. Raphael made to him on, I believe it was January 29th of 2015. And to be clear, he reported that comment to Human Resources. Mr. Raphael admitted making that exact comment that Mr. Allen reported. Mr. Raphael conceded that both in his deposition, in the investigation by Ms. Fisher, and in the summary judgment motion, he did not dispute the fact that he said those things. So exactly what Mr. Allen reported he said. That was the sole involvement that Mr. Allen had in this termination. There is no evidence that Mr. Allen played any other role in the termination other than first reporting the comment and then frankly, cooperating in the investigation by being interviewed.
Other folks within HR or above made the ultimate decision to
terminate? That's correct. Ms. Fisher conducted the investigation, made the recommendation, discussed it with management, and management decided, in line with Ms. Fisher's recommendation, that he should be terminated. And I would note, this was not the only incident we're talking about. There were prior incidents, again, that he's admitted he engaged in, that led up to this. And it's not all about Mr. Allen. There were three independent contractors from three separate companies who also reported that he was behaving aggressively and bullying and intimidating them. Three separate contractors from three separate companies separately reported this. This isn't all about Mr. Allen. Okay. I think you're focusing on the right things. I think those are the issues that that are sort of key here. I think I've addressed those. If you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
What about the issue of the safety complaints that your opposing counsel was addressing at the outset of his argument?
Sure. First of all, the complaints that he made about Mr. Allen, that he wrote to, I think, the CEO of the company and to various other people, those complaints were primarily that Mr. Allen was incompetent, that he was not a good supervisor, that he didn't run a good department. They were not directly related to safety. The primary safety complaints he made were the ones where he was, frankly, haranguing the contractors for not wearing helmets, for not wearing hard hats. Those are the primary safety complaints he made. He hasn't pointed to any specific statute as he would have to. 1102.5 only applies to...
Oh, so you're making a legal response to that rather than a factual response, is that even if he did it, there's no statutory basis for that kind of retaliation?
Yeah.
Is that the idea?
I'd say there's probably three responses to it. The first is he hasn't demonstrated pretext in the actual decision that was made for terminating him. For all the reasons we've been discussing all along, there was good reason to terminate him. He hasn't demonstrated that that was a pretext for anything. To the extent he made a complaint...
But that he was saying that the evidence of pretext is that there was hostility to him, or whatever you want to call it, retaliatory animus towards him for having made a fuss about stuff that he shouldn't have made a fuss about. That's what I took from his argument.
I think that's That's a fair reading of what he said. I believe that his point was that he made a complaint itself, which somehow was evidence of pretext. I'd say that at best that's a protected act. I don't think he even did that, because I think the complaints that we saw were
right.
were not about safety issues, about Mr. Allen being incompetent. Even if he had made a complaint, he would have to have a reasonable belief that it violates some law or statute. He hasn't alleged that. There's no evidence of that anywhere. And then finally, I would say that the reasons that were given for his termination and the investigation that led up to that are very clear, and he hasn't shown that those were a sham in any way. And so that's where you have to get to pretext. You'd have to show that the decision makers were somehow influenced by the fact that he had made a safety complaint sometime before, and he hasn't shown that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Lee, I'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Just wanted to point out that this isn't, as Mr. Chamberlain said, not all about Mr. Allen. There are other decision makers who were notified of the EEOC charge of discrimination, such as Doreen Bartels, who was part of the ultimate decision. So she clearly had knowledge of the protected activity, and she was involved in the termination decision. She was also.
There's no evidence that she did racist things.
Correct. And so that's why I'm focusing again on the retaliation claim.
Oh,
based on the
on
charge
retaliation.
Of discrimination.
But just knowing about knowing about complaints doesn't mean that you don't like people who make them.
Correct, Your Honor.
Do we have to sort of assume that?
No, Your Honor. There is evidence in the fact that as the head of human resources, she is the one who gets to tell people what to investigate, what issues to investigate. And as my point was before.
And is there evidence that she told people to investigate people who made EEOC complaints?
Well, my point is that she refused to investigate my client's multiple complaints.
But that does it follow from that she had retaliatory animus towards him? That's my question.
Yes,
I mean, you could say maybe she incompetently or stubbornly didn't investigate his complaints, but how does that lead to an inference that there was retaliatory animus towards him?
You could just
ignore stuff. I mean, a lot of people do.
I'm not saying Ms. Bartels is incompetent, but what I am saying is that
But you are suggesting that she was mad enough, or whatever the word for animus is, she was animated enough. By that to do something that she shouldn't do, which is fire him for something else.
That's correct, Your Honor.
How do we get that inference? Where do we get the inference that there's the animus, other than you just say there might be?
The inference comes from the juxtaposition of how they treated my client, Mr. Raphael, when there's allegations cursed versus his written complaints
to multiple
people.
This is a comparable kind of argument. Is that what you're making? We're supposed to compare how they treated him versus how they treated the people he was complaining about? Is that the idea?
Mr. Allen, that's correct, Your Honor. And that the handbook that the appellees have says that every single complaint will be duly and properly investigated, something to that effect. Appellees never even talked to Mr. Allen. Mr. Allen, at his deposition, said he had no idea, you know, that my client had any problems with him, that my client felt that he had been harassed, discriminated against, or retaliated against. It was clear that appellees never even...
They similarly situated, though? I mean, one is above the other, right? One is higher?
Correct.
You know, if you're going to make that kind of argument, you have these doctrines that the people have to be similarly situated in order to be a comparable,
yeah,
right?
They're similarly situated in the nature of the complaints. My client complained that he had been singled out, he had been bullied and treated rudely by Mr. Allen. Appellees never even investigated him, never even took the first step of talking to him about those complaints. Versus my client, he was telling people to wear their hard hat in places that he believed it was necessary for their safety, and they terminated his employment.
I got you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Thank both counsel for the argument. Raphael versus Tesoro is submitted.